Thank you. Oh, God. Oh, sorry. hello. Thank you for being here so late in the day. My name is, as you said, Theresia Reinhold. I'm a freelance filmmaker as well as a historian. And as a filmmaker, when I saw this video, The Selfish Ledger by Google, I just had this very strong urge to talk about it. I don't know whether, has ever any one of you seen this before? You have. Okay, that's great, because I'm going to show you the video, not all at once, but in parts, and then I'm going to talk about the several aspects of it. As a quick... you can kind of see it. It's the starting page, the starting image of the video. As you can probably imagine, I'm not a very big fan of globally huge companies. You know, it's not just Google, also companies such as Unilever or BP, Shell, Facebook, and several others come to mind. And when I think about them, the first thing I always think about is the awful things they've done. It's never the good stuff. I'm always thinking about, for example, the oil spill by BP several years ago, or the destruction of the Niger Delta by Shell. Animal cruelty, high fructose corn syrup. Seriously, whatever floats your boat, it will be there and it will be bad. And when Google, when this video by Google came out, it was one of the probably most disgusting or cruel things I've seen. It was made in 2016 by Nick Foster, who is the head of design at X, formerly known as Google X, and the co-founder of the Near Future Lab at Google. So his job is to think about things that could be done potentially in the future. They call this Moonshot Project. And the video was made for internal use only. But luckily, it was obtained, they say, I don't know exactly how they obtained it, but it was obtained by The Verge in May this year. And in this video, Foster toys with the idea of avid data collection and pairing that with artificial intelligence to solve both individual problems as well as the biggest problems in the world, hunger, poverty, depression, sickness, etc. And this video and the topic within it goes far beyond privacy. So what you're about to see, just imagine that privacy is absolutely not an issue anymore. because it's about populist control, it's about controlling behavior, and at the end of the day, it's about exercising power by Google. And of course, it holds a tiny sprinkle of Google's megalomania in it. So I'm first going to show you the first part of the video, hoping that it works. One second. Eingesteckt. Ja, sorry. Eigentlich nicht. No. Sorry. I'm very sorry. Der so aus, oder? Now it should work, hopefully. Thank you. No. Still doesn't work. Cool. Yes, very much. Is this maybe the wrong audio thingy? Audio kommt nur da raus.
Okay.
Aber nicht da. So what do you all think about Google in the meantime? Any opinions about it? Particular loves, interests? Yay.
So maybe Microsoft wants to hack the Privacy Week.
Probably, yeah. Okay. Yes, I think now we have audio.
Ah, great.
No.
No?
It still comes out of the television.
So maybe everyone wants to come over and listen directly to that.
You can help. Any input is very much appreciated.
Okay.
That works. You don't hear a single thing, do you?
The first comprehensive theory of evolution. His book, The Philosophie Zoologique, introduced the notion of an internal code within every living thing, which, when passed down through successive generations, defined the physiological characteristics of a species. At the center of Lamarck's theory laid what he called the adaptive force. He believed that the experiences of an organism during its life modified this internal code. And upon reproduction, this modified version was passed down to its young. Whilst not biologically accurate, and ultimately superseded by Darwin's theory of natural selection, the epigenetic theories put forward by him are beginning to find new homes in unexpected places. When we use contemporary technology, a trail of information is created in the form of data. When analyzed, it describes our actions, decisions, preferences, movement, and relationships. This codified version of who we are becomes ever more complex, developing, changing, and deforming based on our actions. In this regard, this ledger of our data may be considered a Lamarckian epigenome, a constantly evolving representation of who we are. This is Bill Hamilton, one of the most significant evolutionary theorists of the 20th century. His work studying the social structures of ants, bees, and wasps had a profound effect on our understanding of the role of genes in social behaviors such as altruism. He believed, and went on to prove, that the driving force behind evolution was not the individual, but the gene. He stated that the ultimate criterion which determines whether a gene will spread is not whether the behavior is to the benefit of the behavior, but whether it is to the benefit of the gene. In the mid-1970s, the British evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins built on the work of Hamilton and others to popularize the concept of the selfish gene. In his book of the same name, he introduced the notion of a gene which, whilst devoid of any motives or will, could be metaphorically and pedagogically described as if it were. In this model, the individual organism is a transient carrier, a survival machine for the gene. User-centered design principles have dominated the world of computing for many decades, but what if we looked at things a little differently? What if the ledger could be given a volitional purpose rather than simply acting as an historical reference? What if we focused on creating a richer ledger by introducing more sources of information? What if we thought of ourselves not as the owners of this information, but as custodians, transient carriers, or caretakers?
So, I'm sorry for the slight delay, but at the end of the video, it said, what if we thought of ourselves not as the owners of this information, but as custodians, transient carriers? If you look at this video, you probably, or this part that you've seen so far, you probably understand that I have doubts believing Foster's claim that the video was solely a thought experiment. He said, to The Verge, he said, we understand if this is disturbing, it is designed to be. So now they're trying to tell us, oh, well, you know, we just wanted to play around a little bit. But it shows very greatly that Google has an amazingly huge confidence that they could realize such a selfish ledger. It demonstrates even more how much Foster thinks they have the right to do so. Because obviously, if you think about stuff and if you, you know, come to the conclusion that, yeah, that's fine, I can do this, I have the right to do this, then you publish it. If you don't think you have the right to do this, you try to forget about the thought and only tell your closest friends about it. And Google thinks that they know, as you will see a bit later, they would know that what is best for the humans, what is best for us all, and what is best for the world, as in the environment and the planet itself. And even though they avoid the terminology entirely, it is all about controlling and exercising control to pursue a goal, which you will learn about a little bit later. So Google asks for two very specific things in this video. On the one hand, it asks for less privacy, right? And more data collection from more sources to build a huge ledger that doesn't even belong to us. And that is the second thing they ask for. We should stop thinking about our data belonging to us. Everything that we produce, every website we click on, every data trail we have, every email we send, every food we log, and our finances, and all of that, all of those things we put into apps, doesn't belong to us anymore. It mustn't belong to us, because only then it can be used to pursue a greater good. And obviously, Google's business model is the collection and analysis of data. So it's totally unsurprising that they would come up with an idea like this. But I don't know, you probably agree with me on that, every single bit of data that we generate should belong to us, solely us. No one else has a right to use it, own it, keep it, or sell it even. But more importantly for me is you have the right to have something forgotten about you. I don't know whether you've heard of this, but there was this big debate about the right to be forgotten. And everything that we do, we should be able to erase and make, you know, not a part of our open history that is shared with everyone. Because that would leave us with absolutely no room to move in any direction. We couldn't make any mistakes. We couldn't make any bad choices. We couldn't have any, you know, guilty pleasures, such as watching stupid TV series. We won't have an opportunity not to care about something anymore or about messing up. And everything that we do would be in the spotlight and for everyone to look at. And I think that's a very, very creepy thought. The next part of the video, hopefully. Ich mach das schon. Yes, goes into the part of Google in this regard a bit more.
Initially, the notion of a goal-oriented ledger may be user-driven. As an organization, Google would be responsible for offering suitable targets for a user's ledger. Whilst the notion of a global good is problematic, topics would likely focus on health or environmental impact to reflect Google's values as an organization. Once the user selects a volition for their ledger, every interaction may be compared to a series of parallel options. If one of these options allows the ledger to move closer to its goal, it will be offered up to the user. Over time, by selecting these options, the user's behavior may be modified and the ledger moves closer to its target.
Okay, one thing that I forgot to mention, I didn't make the subtitles. It was the subtitles auto-generated by YouTube and I just left them in there for everyone to have an easier time understanding it. So, Google as a company would be responsible for offering suitable targets for a person's ledger. On this app, this Google Resolutions, you could see, well, if you're close enough to the video, that the person clicks on, I want to live more environmentally friendly. And then every time they're about to make a decision and share this with their smartphones, Google offers a better solution, buying their locally grown tomatoes, or using a train instead of their own car, or an Uber carpool or something like that. And Google says they have the responsibility to offer us those solutions because clearly they know what is good, because topics such as health and environmental impact reflect Google's values. I don't know what Google's internal values are, but I know that they have the right to privacy and the protection of people's privacy written in their code of conduct, and everybody signs up to that, and clearly whatever their, you know, goals are, they don't really hold up to them, even though they claim they have the responsibility to do so. So I'm personally very scared of a world in which Google tells us what they think is important and then not even holding up to it. And every selection, you know, that doesn't only mean what we buy, it also, at the end of the day, means behaviors. And behaviors are very personal. You might say, yes, environmentally it's friendlier to ride a train than taking your own car. And probably a lot of people will agree with this because we've heard about it so much. But there might be very personal reasons why you want to take a car. Maybe you have anxiety issues and you can't sit in the full train with strangers every day. Or maybe you really have to rush somewhere. Or maybe you're just really pissed off with the world. And doing that and deciding against the train and for the car already makes people think about their own decisions. So we don't need a bigger entity, an evil one more nonetheless, to tell us, well, what you're doing is really, really bad. And the former Google CEO, Eric Schmidt, very famously said, if you have something that you don't want anyone to know, maybe you shouldn't be doing this in the first place. And granted, Foster is not Eric Schmidt, but I believe that this sentence doesn't only reflect his personal views. I think this sentence reflected Schmidt's views for Google. But I don't have to tell you that just because we don't want someone to know something means we shouldn't be doing it. I don't want you to know that, I don't know, I spend too much time watching Doctor Who, I just told you, because it's one of the less embarrassing things I do. But I wouldn't necessarily want my boss to know or want my friends to know when I just cancel on a dinner date. That doesn't mean I shouldn't be doing it in the first place, because there are issues such as self-care, which are incredibly important, but there are also issues that are incredibly private. And this, for example, has been pointed out very well in the book Feminist Surveillance Studies, because this they say about this assumption by Eric Schmidt, that that it transfers the blame for the threat of discrimination, exclusion, or exploitation onto the victims. And they take the responsibility for that away from the companies and away from the people who discriminate against someone else. So what happens to you, whether it's discrimination, whether it's exclusion, or just judgment, must necessarily be because you are doing something that is incredibly nefarious in the first place. And we need to look at those overlooked forms of exclusion to debunk the myth that there is such a thing as an unbiased and neutral algorithm. Because obviously Google thinks there is such a thing. Because if they think an AI can decide what is best for us and best for the world, it means that the best must be the same for everyone. And it has been shown by very great scholars and such as Kate Crawford or Simone Brown that algorithms and artificial intelligence is as biased as the people who write it. And a surveillance in a form as proposed by Google will not only lead to shaming through an app, but it also will lead to self-censorship, self-monitoring of your behaviors, and adapting according to those rules. And after that, everything is based on fear, on the fear of social exclusion, on the fear of losing, I don't know, credit points, you know, good behavior points or something like that. And what we also have to think about is the question, who has the right to privacy and whose privacy is not a concern? Because surveillance in this form is portrayed by Google as a good thing, basically, a necessary thing. But the book I mentioned before, Feminist Surveillance Studies, really shows and explains that the right to privacy is a very limited lens to use when we talk about surveillance and data collection, because privacy is not equally distributed, and neither is vulnerability. So we have to ask those two questions. And it's very easy to answer them, I think, because the right to privacy is held by people and individuals, or groups and individuals, who are seen as good, per se, mostly based on the fact because they're white and Christian, or read as Christian. And they're seen as rational, as non-threatening, as unemotional, as stable. And black people, people of color, former prisoners, even prisoners for minor offenses such as the possession of weed, are among the ones who are seen as a constant threat and whose right to privacy is already undermined, and it will be even more undermined under such a system as proposed by Google. But then there is the other group of people, such as sick people or people with disabilities. Their privacy is being abolished more and more, pretended it's happening because of a concern about their safety. Or parents, no offense, but a lot of parents constantly ignore the right to privacy of their children. They put pictures online, they tell, you know, funny little stories on Twitter, and they never ask themselves, or maybe they do, they still do it though, whether their children want those informations to be on there when they are grown up. Because the Q story as a child can become embarrassing when you are in your teens. It might even become negative when you're an adult, depending on whatever the Q story was. So Rachel Hall points out that we need to think about the ethical problems of combating new forms of discrimination which are practiced in relation to categories of privilege, access, and risk. And what Google is proposing here, I'm going to lend from bell hooks, who described it as a white, supremacist, capitalist, heteropatriarchal surveillance. Now I'm showing you the next video, or part.
As this line of thinking accelerates and the notion of a goal-driven ledger becomes more palatable, suggestions may be converted not by the user, but by the ledger itself. In this case, the ledger is missing a key data source, which it requires in order to better understand its user. In order to plug the gap in its knowledge, the ledger begins searching for a device which delivers the required data when used. From this list, the ledger begins sorting the options most likely to appeal to the user in question. In situations where no suitable product is found, the ledger may investigate a bespoke solution. By analyzing historical data, it is increasingly possible to discern qualitative information such as taste and aesthetic sensibility, which may be used in the creation of a design proposal. With the advent of technologies such as CNC milling and the emergent possibilities of 3D printing, a custom object may be created to trigger this user's interest. In this way, the ledger is able to plug gaps in its knowledge and refine its model of human behavior.
Hello. Thank you. So as you see in this little video, it shows, the ledger doesn't have the data about somebody's weight. So let's try to plug into other devices. Oh, we can't find information about their weight. So let's propose them with a nice scale that is specifically 3D printed for them so they will buy it because it, pleases their aesthetics and their color choices or the bathroom size or whatever. So as I said, this is far bigger than privacy. It is far more nuanced. We would necessarily move into a world in which individuals think they have a choice, for example, not owning a scale, but they really wouldn't, because they would be nudged very gently into the direction of, hey, give us your weight, because we really need it to tell you what to eat, for example. And what would be the effects on individuals and societies if that came into place? I think it was very adequately described by my friend Paul May as behavioral eugenics. It's a very strong word, but what Google is proposing is also very strong. Because Google's ledger combines a surveillance with normative sanctions. Google decides which kind of behavior is deemed desirable and thereby becomes normal. And that is connected to a whole other set of problems. Because it would not only be about bathroom scales. It would not only be about making the world a better place by not taking a car but taking a train. It would inevitably be used for preempting criminal acts based on the refined knowledge of humans. So what have you done in the past? Who is your peer group? Have your parents been criminals? Are you black? Are you a man? Where do you live? How much money do you have? All of those little things. And it would be connected to the fight against terrorism, which is already a whole huge problem. And the free will and the beliefs of a person would not play a role anymore, because you can fall into a demographic of which the ledger might think most people will become terrorists or criminals. It doesn't mean you will become a terrorist or a criminal, because you still have belief systems. And sure, I believe it would be amazing to live in a world without crime, without fear, without terrorism, but it would put a lot of innocent people into a great risk and more suspicion than they're already living under. Because the prejudice about someone would be a part, inevitably, of the equation. And there we're not just talking about racism, we're also talking about classicism, anti-Semitism, and the hatred of people who are from certain countries or regions in the world, language, spaces, religions. Because all of those things, yes, they do inform our behavior, but they don't inform our behavior necessarily in a wrong way. And the new reinforcement of segmentation, segregation, will destroy decades of the fights for women's rights, trans people's rights, people of color, women of color, the Black Lives Matter movement, fights for people with disabilities, fights against class segregation. I mean, the list goes on and on and on, and we have been fighting for those things for hundreds of years in some cases, only for a few dozen. But I don't want to live in a world where a company that has far too much influence already tells me whether I should go on a demonstration because I have to go there by car and that is environmentally unfriendly, or whether I should stay at home and do my work because I'm late on a deadline.
Use user data has the capability to survive beyond the limits of our biological selves, in much the same way as genetic code is released and propagated in nature. By considering this data through a Lamarckian lens, the codified experiences within the ledger become an accumulation of behavioral knowledge throughout the life of an individual. By thinking of user data as multi-generational, it becomes possible for emerging users to benefit from the preceding generation's behaviors and decisions. As new users enter an ecosystem, they begin to create their own trail of data. By comparing this emergent ledger with the mass of historical user data, it becomes possible to make increasingly accurate predictions about decisions and future behaviors. As cycles of collection and comparison extend, it may be possible to develop a species-level understanding of complex issues such as depression, health, and poverty. Our ability to interpret user data, combined with the exponential growth in sensor-enabled objects, will result in an increasingly detailed account of who we are as people. As these streams of information are brought together, the effect is multiplied. New patterns become apparent and new predictions become possible.
New patterns become apparent and new predictions possible through a multi-generational ledger of data. If that gives Google anything, then it's a position of power. And by power, I don't mean violence. I mean Google already has a position of power based on years of invention and long-standing success in terms of user numbers and market share, right? And it has a business model that people buy into, which makes them one of the richest companies in personal data in the world. It knows stuff about us, I'm quite sure, that some state institutions likely would like to know as well. But the power I'm talking here is different than the power a state holds, because it's almost invisible. It doesn't have to be shown as power. It is shown as care, as ideas they offer us to make the world a better place. And it's, of course, a form of capitalist power, because when large amounts of people have to buy your product and have to buy into your philosophy, whatever it is that it offers, they are societally obliged to do this. You know, a lot of people who don't like Google have to use Google products because of their work environment, because it's efficient, because it makes it so easy to connect with others or to work together on a presentation, or it's easy to search for things because you get personalized search results. And not participating in Google at all is incredibly difficult. Because there is Google and things, you know, a lot of people forget about. For example, fonts when they build their websites. And Max Weber, I don't know whether you've ever heard of this quite omnipresent German sociologist, he described power. I don't have that. Okay. He described power as the ability of an individual group to achieve their own goals and aims, even then when others are trying to prevent them from realizing them. And I think that applies here, because even if we have a problem with Google collecting and analyzing our data, we still participate because we have to. We very willingly sacrifice privacy, but also our right to an intimate zone for the comfort that those products offer, or because we don't have the money or the time to get alternatives. We might not have the money to buy an iPhone if you think Apple is the better company, but you might also not have the time to run everything on Linux and on open source software and, you know, basically hack your way and the way of your friends and coworkers through an anti-Google zone. And that is where another researcher comes in, whose name was Niklas Luhmann, who said that power does not only come from within itself, but through the people buying into its power. Because if no one suddenly, if everyone suddenly would stop using Google's products, it would entirely lose not only its market share, but its power that it holds. What could Google do? It could try to make better products, but what if we resist? Would it use force or violence? I don't think so. And even if, that is then, as described by Hannah Arendt, the absence of power, if you have to resort to violence. And power is most powerful in areas where we don't expect it and where we don't see it. Because a continuously powerful entity doesn't have to showcase the possession of power. It probably is better off if it doesn't. If it doesn't tell you, hey, I'm powerful. Google never said, hey, I'm powerful. Google always just said, hey, we offer the best solutions. And power is also about social engineering. And that is the last part of the video where we see how, well, suggestive Google is about the idea and the result and the conclusion they draw.
Since the 1970s, huge efforts have been made in sequencing the human genome. Today, after many years of research and billions of data points, that sequence is known. By adopting a similar perspective with user data, we may begin to better understand its role. Just as the examination of protein structures paved the way to genetic sequencing, the mass, multi-generational examination of actions and results could introduce a model of behavioral sequencing. As gene sequencing yields a comprehensive map of human biology, researchers are increasingly able to target parts of the sequence and modify them in order to achieve a desired result. As patterns begin to emerge in the behavioral sequences, they too may be targeted. The ledger could be given a focus, shifting it from a system which not only tracks our behavior, but offers direction towards a desired result. We are at the very beginning of our journey of understanding in the field of user data. By applying our knowledge of epigenetics, inheritance, and memetics to this field, we may be able to make mental leaps in our understanding, which could offer benefits to this generation, to future generations, and the species as a whole.
Remember in the beginning, Google showed you an app where you could tell them which goal you have and then they present you with better options. I believe with this idea they buy right into the trend that has been happening for several years, the trend of self-optimization. We are presented with ideas how to optimize ourselves and they do feel like they are our own choices, right? Eat a little more healthy, buy more local, exercise more, study harder, sleep regularly, all of those things. But I don't believe that they are choices, even though they are presented in such a way, because as I said before, they are based on the fear of repercussions if you don't go along that line, especially in a world where everyone does it. Because if everyone is looking over your shoulder at the whole time, how would you make a decision? Which job would you get if you were in a completely surveyed world? Whom would you date? Which TV shows would you watch and which friends would you have? What would you say when you are interrogated by the police because something bad happened to a friend of yours? There's an incredible sense of fear in there, which obviously Google never tells you or even hints at, because the tone of this video is nice. You know, it's like a grandfather who just wants to help you be a better person. And I have a short personal conclusion that came from working on this video, or with this, not on this video, but working along the lines of the video. And I was asking myself whether and how many of those effects are already in place. Because we use Netflix, Spotify, Apple Music, we use Google search. And why do we trust apps to control what we eat, what we wear, whom we have sex with? Where to go for lunch and how to lose or gain weight, how fit to be, when to work, when to make breaks, how to stay in touch with other people, when to call your parents, Google the problems you are having to find out which, you know, disease you might be having, you always die by the way, what to read, track your monthly cycle, track your sleep rhythms, your financial expenses, grocery shopping lists, all of those things. And everything could be done analog. You can very easily track your expenses or your monthly cycle in a notebook where nobody has ever access to it. But we don't, because we buy into this feeling of convenience. Thank you.
Okay, so thank you very much. That was also an incredibly good talk. So I'm again shocked, like after the last talk, there's so many things I don't know, and I've, oh my God. It's like, hey, we see the new formation of religion. So as we have 15 minutes before the next talk, if you're okay with it, there can be some questions, but who wants can leave? But yeah, so do we have any questions? If there are no questions, so I thought about the quote you brought at the beginning. Did anyone ever, the thing about if you have something to hide, blah, blah, blah. Did anyone ever suggest to Google that they should treat their patents like this and their copyrights? So if they have something they want no one to know, so why don't they make it? So why is Google not an open source company if that's their credo? I don't understand this.
Very good question, Google, if you're listening.
Yeah, so that was, and this for you, maybe for you, so there was, yesterday there was a talk by Christian Swerts, and he talked about that humans must have the ability to reinvent themselves all the time, and that was very, very much along the line what you said. It was very interesting. So really, no questions by anyone else. Okay, so we have one question. Over there.
It's one of these boring statements and not questions. But what I saw in this video is perhaps a shiny philosophical veneer on something that many other people think as well, and I think we really have a fight to fight here. I recognized the kind of talking that we've seen from Chancellor Merkel in the last few months and years, repeating the kind of talk from the industry about what we call data wealth when we translate this, Datenreichtum. The idea that it's not about you controlling your data, it's about profiting from giving your data away. I think that's the kind of thinking behind both those industry representatives and Angela Merkel and this video in a way. And I think we really have to fight that quite strongly and come back to the idea that we have already fought and established about data protection and basic rights. And there is a certain common theme behind this that we really should be aware of, or wary of.
Yes, I agree.
Okay, one more question.
Hello, yeah. First of all, it sounds like they read Mark Ellsberg's Zero, but not till the end, just as a side note. But your note at the end was to kind of don't use it at all, because we can write an analog, I don't know, grocery list or something else. But that's quite, I mean, that's sad, isn't it? Can't we, isn't there a possibility to form a society or laws or something that we still can use the technology we are able to build? I mean.
Hey, I would absolutely love that. I would love a society in which I can even, I don't know, use Google. No, it's called Gmail, right? Without Google looking not only through the metadata, but at the actual contents of my emails. I would love that. Because I also want this convenience. I try to get my classmates to use a pad instead of a Google product. And that alone is a very, very hard task, because they all have Gmail accounts, so why not use a doc? And I want to be able to use that. And I also would love to be able to create better open source technology. I'm unfortunately completely unskilled, but I support everyone strongly and sometimes financially who does that.
Thanks.
So then I'd say thanks again. Thanks.
Thank you.
A lot for being here. And well, so we'll continue. One more remark?
Just an addition, because you mentioned Google Pads and Google Docs, and everybody's using them because they're convenient. The Chaos Computer Club Vienna is also hosting an instance for collaborative text editing, sketching, taking notes, and these things, and you can use that freely. It's zero knowledge, so we don't see any of your content on the server, even as system administrators, of which I'm one. You don't have to trust me. So you can just use them. They're available for free. We host this as a service because we need such a thing ourselves. Go to pads.c3w.at and enjoy the service.
Thank you. Woo!